This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. Today, I am joined by an incredible human being, but before I bring her in, I want to give a viewer discretion advice due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing today, including religious trauma and a number of other topics. And again, viewer discretion is advised. Today, I am joined by my friend, Meg McDermott. Meg, welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
I am as well. And you know, this is one of my favorite topics to talk about because deconstructing religion and understanding how it is in our country right now and how it runs rampant. And, you know, we don't really have the separation of church and state anymore, really, because it's more of like, well, here we're a Christian nation. Here's this, here's that. And as a progressive Christian myself, I say that because I embody the true Christian spirit. And whenever I think of that, I think of James Tallarico in Texas, who is running for U.S. Senate, using religion in a way that is helping people because, no, the Bible says to feed the poor. It also says love thy neighbor. That includes your immigrant neighbor. That includes your gay neighbor. That includes your trans neighbor. That includes your disabled neighbor and helping those that are around you. So I would love for you to just give an introduction to who you are. Feel free to tell people who you are, the, you know, what led you into the work that you're doing. And part of this podcast is we're unhinged, we're unfiltered. And I know that's right up your alley.
Yes, free as a bird over here.
And you're an open book too, which is why I love talking to people like you because it makes it a lot easier. And I understand that not everybody's at that level of healing, and that's completely valid. But the other point of this podcast is to help people get to that point by understanding that there are other people out here that have been through something similar that you have or that I have. It makes people feel less alone. So without further ado, feel free to introduce yourself, let people know who Meg McDermott is and what led you to doing this work.
Oh my gosh, incredible. Thank you so much. Love James Tallarico, BT Dubs. When I saw he was running for Senate, he officially announced his bid. I've clicked onto the Instagram account that they made for that. And the entire bio, the only thing it says is it's time to flip some tables. And I got full body chills. I was like, yes, James. But hi, my name is Meg McDermott. And I struggle when people are like, what do you do? Because I do very many things and a lot of them don't really fit into boxes in a way that we're used to. I think in our economy, when we say, what do you do? A lot of people are like, that's your job, right? That's what I'm asking you. What's your job? What do you do in the world? I do priestess work, which is very weird and very interesting and very kooky. And it's not something I ever really planned to do, but it kind of runs in my family. I was born into a deeply Irish American Catholic family with a lot of kind of spooky roots, is what I like to say, in terms of a Celtic lineage of energy work and spiritual leadership. And that, you know, if you pull the thread back through generations in my family, I'm the first generation in a long time that has had the safety to be able to fully claim that and talk about it and do that work in public in a way that is safe because it it predominantly has been women and feminine people in my family line where, you know, it wasn't safe to be outside the box. It still isn't safe to be outside the box, but it's safer now for me than it was for anyone that came before me. And before that, I worked in arts education nonprofits in New York City. And before that, I worked in film and television, and I did comedy and music all over New York City. I'm still a musician and a songwriter. And a lot of people might know me from my Instagram or from years ago on TikTok. I share content that's kind of at the intersection of empowering the self as a spiritual or divine being, that we all are perfectly divine and perfectly human, imperfectly human. And a lot of that deals with shedding shame and also looking at the reality we are in and how we contribute to it and shifting the ways that we show up in our reality so that we can embody love as much as possible. So, love for me is not a feeling, it is a choice that we make and a frequency that we have the opportunity and the privilege to embody. And it's an action, right? I love this one song lyric from the Bad Books. They say, love isn't passive, a trick or a tactic. It's radical action. And that's how I feel about love. And love is also the kind of my name for what other people might call God, or spirit or creator or divinity or source. You know, there are like a million words for the same thing that all loving, unconditionally loving, energetic force that animates life, right? It makes us feel connected to one another and connected to the earth and connected to the universe. And at the same time, simultaneously, so unique and undeniably you, right? Like what makes you and what makes me me, but and makes us connected, but also different. That's love. That's love, in my opinion, or in my kind of worldview. So I've been teaching people, I've been teaching predominantly other people who do energy work, other highly sensitive, intuitive people who are here to use that in the world at this time. We are in a crisis of empathy, right? There's quite literally been a war declared on empathy from the Christian nationalist movement. And, you know, the Christian industrial complex has weaponized the idea of Jesus, the idea of Christianity, and totally flipped it on its head to systemize harm. You know, we've created these systems of harm that people are profiting off of. I like to say we live in a death cult, and I'm not the only person that says that, right? I've seen that language used more and more recently, but so much of what I've done throughout my entire life has been in defiance of the death cult. And I have a really interesting perspective because I was raised very in a very devout Irish Catholic family. Very liberal, very, very socially liberal, fiscally liberal, all about social safety nets, all about love being love, and all about women, like very strong women in my family. And also my family was very deeply intellectual. And that's very typical of a certain kind of Irish Catholic family that have these kind of druid roots from the time before the church really colonized Ireland and the Celtic culture. So, you know, I remember I went to Catholic school growing up. I graduated from a pre-K through 12 Catholic school, teeny tiny. And my mom worked there so that we could afford it because we got a tuition benefit when she, you know, took a pay cut from working at the public school to work at the Catholic school I went to. Started going there when I was four, graduated when I was 18. And I remember driving home from church regularly because we were in church all the time. My parents were on every committee, and you know, the church, we built a new church and the school almost closed. We were running out of money. And my dad was it was integral in keeping the church open and keeping the school open. And so we were really, really deeply involved, right? Like fully in it. And yet, I remember routinely when we would be driving home from church on Sundays, my dad explaining to us why what the priest had said was wrong. If ever there was anything that was kind of, super violent, because that's the thing, we've totally like used Christianity and this idea of Christianity and kind of a punishing God that has a hierarchy of who he loves and why from the great cloud in the sky that he sits on with his white skin and his blue eyes and his big white beard. It's been that concept of God has been used to scare people into accepting this sanitized violence. And language is so important, right? Because it creates the environment in which we feel comfortable or even emboldened to act in specific ways. So, if a priest is preaching anything that isn't, radical love, I was taught like, yeah, don't listen to that guy. Or like learn media literacy, really, is what it was. I was being taught reading comprehension, but for speeches and speaking. And so being raised at this intersection of we're critical of this institution, but we also are going to marry ourselves to it so that we have the resources that we need to help people, because my family's really big on public service. Everyone on both sides of my family, in that direct line for my, maternal line and paternal line, everyone was working, in service to the community in their day jobs, but then also volunteering. Like my childhood was spent volunteering. I've been volunteering my whole life. My dad always says, if you don't volunteer, no one will. So always make sure you volunteer no matter what's going on. And it's interesting. It was very confusing growing up, being as sensitive as I am and as precocious as I was, being sensitive energetically and just emotionally, and then being precocious, being able to see through the lies and the ways that the church or Jesus was, this idea of Jesus I was being taught and fed, was he was walking and talking in two different directions, right? Like it I routinely got not in trouble, but I pissed off a lot of my teachers growing up, because I would ask so many questions, or I would ask one question that highlighted a contradiction in what they had just taught me in religion class, which is something I got a grade on from the time I was 4 years old, is religion, and the history of the Catholic Church and the Catechism and the saints and all of it, right? And it was real. The gaslighting was crazy. The gaslighting went absolutely bobo bonkers bananas. And I've spent so much time in therapy and really actively deconstructing how I was, told one thing and then told another thing and then told to go do something that didn't align with either of the first two things. And then when I said, hey guys, this isn't adding up, being told like, well, that's because I'm bad and evil, right? Like I did something wrong and that's why it's not adding up, because I have sinned and I need to repent. Like it was just very confusing, but also very clear at the same time. And when I graduated high school, I went to NYU. I moved to New York. My mom's family is originally from New York, and it's the most at home I've ever felt. Full disclosure, I'm in Virginia right now. I live in Virginia and I miss New York. I've been missing New York so deeply. So if you hear me, if you can feel me through your headphones emoting as I talk about New York, it's because I really miss it more than I have in a long time. But I went to NYU for college and I studied dramatic writing, which is basically the history of drama. The history it started with the foundations of the program I was in, was the history of the written word and the history of story. And then over the course of the program, it evolves more into a screenwriting program because it's the film school at NYU. And at the same time, I was taking all of these classes in psychology and in Irish history and the history of the Irish diaspora. I took a couple classes on evangelicalism in America, on the history of medicine in the ancient world. And it's so interesting because all of those classes that I took as electives were so nourishing to me, and it were so challenging and expansive, and I devoured them. I'm obsessed. I've always been obsessed with culture and just dissecting culture. But it's interesting because they seemed kind of disconnected from each other when I was taking them. But now, looking at where we are, like I was thinking about, I had forgotten that I took a class on the history of medicine in the ancient world. And I've been reminded of it recently with the Make America Healthy Again movement, where I'm just like, guys, this is so absurd. Because I remember sitting in that class being like, why did people believe these absurd things about the human body and the sources of different ailments? Like, how could they be so dense, even though they didn't have the information or the access to information or technology that we have now? How could they possibly believe that their migraines were caused by demons in their skull, so they need to drill a hole in the back of their skull to get rid of the demons, and then that'll get rid of their migraines? And then I look around and I'm like, oh, that's happening again now, about like so many different ailments, and where the source of the actual ailment isn't being properly acknowledged.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The RealReal. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
So no solution to that ailment could possibly be found because you're starting at the wrong point in your research process. Anyway, all that to say, when I look back at that period of time, it was a time of deconstruction for me. And it was, the actual deconstruction process took place a few years later after college when I had time and space to breathe, because I was at NYU on all scholarships and loans and was doing comedy full time. It was like a full time job, and had internships and had multiple work study jobs and then was babysitting and picking up gigs here and then performing. Like, it was just, there was so much going on, but I really was, I feel like I was kind of dipped in a vat of everything I needed, like energetically, to deconstruct later. And in terms of a practical knowledge sense of understanding these systems, and my brain sees systems. I'm very creative, but I also, the kind of intuitive I am, I can see the way that energy moves through individuals and the way that energy moves through systems and the way that those two things interact on the micro and macro levels. And so I feel like I was really just a sponge absorbing all of this data about all of that. And then when I had time and space and took time and space later, when we were all quarantining, it all kind of came together, and I all of a sudden just was kind of a level of deconstructed, where I had been deconstructing consciously since I was in elementary school. I was deconstructing, and my parents were both a part of that process supportively and then working against it at the same time, which was also confusing. But when I was, later on in adulthood, it all kind of just clicked into place, where I was like, oh, I just see how this is all connected from such a higher point of view, like a bird's eye view. And then I'm also feeling it deeply in my own personal experience. So a lot of what I do in my practice as a priestess, which a priestess, coming from an Irish lineage, an Irish American lineage, but hearkening back to kind of the old country and the old way, it's very much druid-like, or what we know of the druids. They famously didn't write anything down out of respect for the mysteries that they were charged with being a keeper of and a teacher of. They were often political advisors, legal advisors, spiritual advisors. They were integral in creating and implementing laws and systems within the community structure that were informed by their perspective and their study of divinity, and they also oftentimes had a natural gift for channeling or healing, what have you. And there were different, there are so many different roles like that in kind of a pre-church Ireland. And I think in most places in Europe, specifically pre-church, we don't really, when we talk about decolonizing, I feel like that's usually the last place people look, right? Because there are so many more pressing matters in terms of decolonizing to create safety in our immediate environment for the people around us and for ourselves. But that's such a big part of what I do, is helping people who were raised in this Christian nationalist environment, because it's been this way the whole time, right? Like, it's so funny to me in a kind of cosmic sense. It's really not funny, but in a cosmic sense, it's funny to me that we've ever talked about separation of church and state with a straight face. When people came here to be a specific kind of Christian. And it was like, yeah, we came here for religious freedom. We all want to be different kinds of Christian. I'm like, okay. And then those are that informed who then wrote our founding documents. And when we look at the demographic of who wrote our founding documents and why they believed what they believed, and the ideas of manifest destiny, and then also being people who were somehow super, Christian and super, I think by today's standards, like socially conservative, and also like believed that they most of them believed that they owned other people, right? So like, I don't know, I just find it so fascinating that we're all waking up to it now. It feels less like it's been a resurgence of it. I think it's definitely more, people feel more empowered to perform Christian nationalism. And obviously, there's been a takeover of the government that is really bad and is having, there's a tangible physical impact that we haven't seen at this level, with this level of aggression, and including that, so many different demographics of people being victimized by this system so aggressively. We haven't seen that in a really, really long time, and it's horrifying. And it's a product of this system. The system has always been that same energy, just with different, the volume turned up or down. And so much of what I do as a priestess is helping other people who are leaders in their communities or in their family line, and who are actively deconstructing, really release their shame and really learn to trust themselves, because that's something that the Christian industrial complex and this authoritarian regime banks on. They need us to trust, to doubt ourselves. They root and seed this doubt in all of us from the time we're so small. And it's not just people who are raised in the church, because our entire education system, our entire kind of cultural, social con so many social contracts we have with one another have the energy of, those Christian foundations of this nation woven throughout them. And so I really help people uncover their authentic selves outside of their own trauma, their religious trauma specifically, a lot of the time, because I work with a lot of very deeply intuitive and spiritually powerful women or feminine people who are meant to have agency and be in positions of leadership because of the wisdom that they carry and the quick, powerful, potent, undeniable to the people around them, almost miraculous sometimes access that they have to that wisdom and the ways that they're positioned in their lives. I help them uncover that part of themselves that is really authentically them, underneath that conditioning from our culture, underneath the intergenerational trauma, underneath the religious trauma and conditioning. And I help them release everything out of their lives that is inhibiting them from standing in that fully embodied, so that they can not just, of course it's self-actualizing, it feels good in that regard, but it's not about that. And that's not why I'm here. And that's not why the people like me are here. We are here quite literally to create as one form of reality that is based in fear and lies, and using the concept, the idea of love and divinity to destroy people and to profit off of killing people and harming people and making people suffer as that reality, as we work to tear that down and deconstruct that, people like me are here to rebuild in real time. We're weavers. We're weavers of a new way. And that can happen in really big, powerful ways, right? Like I, work with people who are in some very powerful positions, and I advise them and I help them process and I help them make decisions. Powerful people politically, socially, in business. But I also, it also happens in these small moments where it's just how you choose to respond to a person at the grocery store who maybe snaps at you and seems like they are opposed to you. Or they might, sometimes people seem like they're moving through life, believing the world is opposed to them. And so it's a lot of boundary work, a lot of work in staying open within those boundaries, and really creating and weaving this new reality in real time, which requires the deconstruction of the old reality and these old systems and kind of rewriting it. I kind of think of myself as like a coder for individual people. When it comes to my one-on-one work or my group work that I do with clients, where I help them when they need a software upgrade or when they've kind of been activated into a sort of software upgrade of like, oh, I can't do things the old way anymore. You know how, like, I don't know, say you have like a toxic friend or something, and then they say something, you've been having weird feelings, you couldn't really place them, and then they say something, and all of a sudden it's so clear and you can't unhear it, and it kind of changes everything. That's what I equate that to, getting a software upgrade, and then you have to like implement it, you have to integrate it, you have to rewire yourself or rewrite that code in terms of how you're showing up, because that sort of thing shifts, everything. We're really great at compartmentalizing. Late stage capitalism has really convinced us we are little robots that can create these compartments of ourselves. And when I'm at work, I'll think about work. And when I'm at home, I'll think about home. And when I'm with this person, I'll be this version of myself. And when I'm over here, I'm this. And everything has a value. All I have to earn, prove my value by earning, right? Like earning through labor. But that's not how we actually are designed. We are one being. And yes, I think there's definitely something to be said for like having a different, I don't know, different vibe, showing up in different spaces or for different conversations with a different energy, depending on who's there and what your role in that space is. But overall, we're not designed to be so separate from ourselves and separate from each other. So it's really a process of coming back into a deep unity with yourself, unifying all the different aspects of yourself, not leaving any aspect of yourself behind. And that can be a really painful process when you were raised, especially with so many of the people I work with were raised in the church. So when you're raised in an environment that teaches you this part of you is good and this part of you is bad, point blank, period. It's black and white. If you indulge the part of yourself that is good, you'll earn God and eternal life in heaven. If you indulge the part of yourself that is quote unquote bad, you will earn hell and eternal damnation, and it will be your fault, right? It's so capitalist. It's the same fucking thing where it's like, oh, I have to go prove I deserve to have food, clothing, and shelter. Oh, I have to prove to an invisible man in the sky that I deserve to not burn for eternity, and I'm starting in a deficit. Like, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And they work hand in hand with one another. Yeah. So that's where I am. That was like a very long-winded answer. I don't even, I'm gonna, full disclosure, my friend, I don't even really remember what you asked me, but here we are. I hope that was a nice little introduction to who I am and my vibe and the kinds of different things that I do.
And just know that I will not edit that out because that's absolutely crucial, and I absolutely fucking love it because you know how I am by now. So essentially, you embody like this like healing process and like within yourself, you know, and it's like this decolonization and like this deconstruction of what religion looks like and what it is and what it does. We know what it does. You know, I went through conversion therapy for 2.5 years, and I remember sitting in this dark room of like this screen and just watching these videos of sexual acts between the same sex. And I would have like these electrodes attached to different parts of my body. And you know, the point of that is to associate my attraction with pain to the same sex. Now, I want to add a full disclosure that I was not forced into it by my parents. However, society told me that something was wrong with me and I needed to change. Because at that time, who was running rampant throughout our country, and they were
Yeah.
very heavy, was the Westboro Baptist Church,
Yeah.
which unfortunately I live in Kansas and I live just an hour north of where the Westboro Baptist Church is. And every time I go down to the state capitol, you drive literally right by it and you can't help but see it. And it's like this big ass like wooden fence around it, and they have like up to 10,000 cameras. And right across the street is a LGBTQ house. It's like rainbow, and then there's a trans flag right next to it too, or like a trans a trans house. And it was strategically placed to be the give people like, and you can literally stand in the middle of the road and just see two separate ideologies. You see hate,
Yeah.
you see love. And you can just see it and you can feel it whenever you're standing there, because you're looking over here and you see, oh, God hates fags, and you see, oh, homosexual is a sin, and all this other stuff. And unfortunately, whenever I went to my first Pride Festival back in 2000, probably like 2011, 2012, I was like 14 or 15 at the time, I had a run-in with Fred Phelps. He was actually there,
Oh my
and
gosh.
that was a very interesting interaction, because I'm like, who the hell is this wrinkly old ass man that's sitting here like preaching about this? And then I get back home, I research who they are, and I was like,
Yeah.
oh God, this is what I saw on Facebook. This is who, my friends idolize. This is, and I'm like, are these really friends? Are they really trying to like plot something against me? Because
Yeah.
it's like this whole cult within a cult in itself.
Yeah.
But, thinking about the work that you do, right? Walk us through, growing up in religion. I know you touched on it a little bit. Let's do a deep dive into that, right? Obviously, there's certain parts that is, off limits essentially, but you're a fairly open book, and I know you talk a lot about the work that you do now, like this deconstruction and like this, just bringing out, your true self. But it hasn't always been like that, and
Yeah.
let's walk through that.
Yeah. Well, first I just want to say, Zachary, I'm so proud of you for, going through that experience when you were younger and going to conversion therapy and being who you are in the world now. And, on behalf of our culture and our society, I'm so sorry that you felt that was something you had to put yourself through, and I'm so proud of you for being here and for being who you are, and for even just being able to say that out loud indicates that you've really gotten to a place of releasing shame around who you are, but then also I imagine like really tough forgiveness, like a journey of forgiveness of yourself and other people for that situation. And so I just want to let you know I'm really genuinely proud of you, and I'm grateful that you're here, and I'm grateful that you're here exactly as you are. And thank you for sharing that with me here and trusting me to share that with me, but also, trusting other people who come across your content and who come across this podcast and who come across the work that you do, because it's so helpful for other people, not just people who are younger than you who might be feeling pressured into that space to know that they don't have to do that, but also for people who did go through it and maybe are struggling to reconcile that part of their experience with where they are now and who they are now. So just thank you for sharing that, because I'm sure it wasn't easy to go through and isn't easy to share. And I just want to acknowledge that the work that you're doing right now, this is important.
Thank you for that. I do greatly appreciate you saying that. And on this podcast, we have these deep discussions, because I believe that these stories need to be shared. And a lot of times people rely on the mainstream media to share these stories. And then they're
Yeah.
very surprised whenever they learn that, oh, mainstream media is not going to share the story. Oh, I listen to this on a podcast. This isn't
Yeah.
mainstream media, my friends. Like, I'm not backed by a billionaire. I'm not
Yeah.
backed by a corporation. I'm not backed by any specific party. I am literally independent. This is an independent podcast. And I'm also not a journalist. I'm a survivor, and
Yeah.
I'm an advocate for change and a catalyst for change. And I believe in telling the human story behind the mask, doing these unmasking conversations and having the hard-hitting discussions that people typically don't want to talk about. I know that they're taboo, but that makes it even more important for me to share because is it really taboo or people just don't give a damn, you know, and that's the reality of it. And, you know, oftentimes survivors of sexual and gender-based violence and sexual assault, domestic violence, you know, just survivors in general are oftentimes told, so what were you wearing? Or, you know, who were you with at that time? Was it legit? You know,
How
these are
did
the
you earn
questions.
it?
Yes. And these are the questions that I was asked by my own police department that was
Wow.
supposed to help me. But, you know, I mean, it's literally on the side of their car. It's to serve and to protect. Who exactly are you serving and protecting whenever you tell me that, oh, well, you're a man. You're supposed to fight him off and all this other shit. And it's like, I wouldn't be here trying to make a report if it didn't happen. I mean, I understand that false reporting happens. I get that. I understand that. I don't want to diminish that. However, is that really that time or place to understand that? No. You know, like, with all due respect, police are not supposed to be the jury, judge, and executioner. Like, they're supposed to be there to help you get to that point. But anyway, let's do a deep dive into, you know, growing up under, like, believing, like, what these stereotypes are about what religion's supposed to be, what it's supposed to look like, and how you're supposed to go to church every single day, or, you know, every Wednesday and every Sunday, like I did for a while, like in high school. I was going with my friend that actually introduced me to the pastor that did this to me. But, and that's a whole different thing that I can get into that later on. But just walk me through a little bit of your journey, you know, in that regard, in that aspect.
So I was born into, I'm the third child, in an Irish American Catholic family. I say Irish American Catholic instead of Irish Catholic because people who live in Ireland are like, you're not Irish Catholic, you're Irish American Catholic. And I'm like, for sure, two different things, definitely. Two different cultures. Definitely some parallels, and obviously they're connected and related, but it is two different kind of the diaspora really does a number on the psyche, and also staying in, so to saying, in Ireland in different ways that manifest in different ways sometimes. So I was born into a family of you know, my dad went to Catholic school growing up. His parents were Catholic. My dad is 99.98% Irish. He's very into genealogy and ancestry, and hit the other 0.02% is Scottish. So he's really, really, really Irish, more so than a lot of Irish people you'll find in America, Irish American people. It's kind of been, you know, people have had kids with other people, which is great. But in my dad's family, he's the first generation that married someone who's not also 100% Irish on both sides of their family. So, you know, those roots run really deep, and there was a really uninterrupted line on my father's side of that, just that ancestry. And that includes the power and the gifts and the wisdom from that ancestry, but also the pain and the trauma and the disruptions. And I was born in a deficit, I'd say, in terms of being what's considered acceptable by the Catholic Church. And, you know, no one has to believe the story that I'm about to tell. That's not why I'm telling it. But the day that I was born, 12 after I was 12 hours after I was born, I went septic and I stopped breathing. And it was in the middle of the night. It was very dramatic. And when I was about, you know, 1.5 or 2 years old, I started talking. I started speaking pretty early. And I would tell whoever would listen, I would frequently talk about how when I was born, first I came down from heaven and I met mommy. And then I went back up to heaven and I sat on God's lap and it was warm. And God asked me if I wanted to stay there or go be with mommy. And I said I wanted to go be with mommy. And I would say this. I would say this to all kinds of people. And my grandmother, my dad's mom, who is very spooky, she had a lot of she was a very spiritually powerful person, and a lot of things would happen around her and through her that were kind of unexplainable and mystical, but we didn't talk about it. Like, we weren't supposed to talk about it, which makes sense because she was born in 1930 and she, you know, lived in West Virginia for a lot of her life. So it quite literally was not safe for her to, be a Matilda of sorts, like making weird shit happen around her. And that was a threat to the status quo that she was born into. So, she told my mom, because she ended up being my keeper. I have two older siblings and they're 4 and 6 years older than me. So I was kind of, when you're little, that's a pretty big age difference. Like they were always doing stuff together and I was always a little too little to join them in it. So, and because my parents had the jobs that they had the salaries that they had, and were always doing mission work kind of outside of their jobs that were also mission work, we didn't have really a lot of extra money. We always had what we needed, but we really didn't have a lot of money. And that was highlighted by all of the very wealthy people I grew up around in on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, the Hamptons of the Chesapeake Bay, they call it. Thank you so much. It was interesting to see like the kind of intersections of different tax brackets there, in terms of like the service industry workers and the people I grew up with, like in my neighborhood, but then the very wealthy people who, I went to school with at the Catholic school that had tuition involved. But all this to say, my grandma was my keeper. She was my babysitter, and she started teaching me about plants and about the stars and she taught me how to read palms. She would show me specific films and be like, pay attention to this part. And she would read me weird books, and she taught me so much. And I remember like burying a statue of a specific saint in her yard, and like for a specific reason. She would say stuff in Latin. So it was like this weird hybrid, right, of like Catholicism and Irish Catholicism specifically, but then also things that would be considered more quote unquote pagan, or more earth-based. And that was very intentional when I studied, the diaspora, and also studied, after college. I've done a lot of work in my ancestry and studying, the evolution of more earth-based spiritual practices as pertains to Celtic culture and Irish culture specifically. So many people, so many mystics hid themselves in the church so that they would not be killed. Like that was quite literally, part of assimilation was like, how can I weave some of what we believe to be true, and our practices, and it's in our DNA too. Like biologically, I come from a long line of people who have like grieved in a certain way when someone dies. So we have an Irish wake, which has some pagan stuff woven into it. So there, she was my keeper, and she told my mom when I was very young, and I had started telling this story about my birth trauma. She saw something, she met something, some kind of divinity. There was something that touched her, life and death in the same moment. And my grandfather was still alive at that point, my grandmother's husband, and he was a deeply, deeply Catholic person, but he also was a chemist and a brilliant scientist. And my dad used to challenge him and say, like, when my dad was a hippie in college, he was like, how can you be both of these things? How can you be a man of science and still believe in religion and God and all this stuff? And he said, well, in science, when we find an answer to a question, it opens up 1,000 more questions. And it's all just leading us to the same place. It's the mysteries, it's God, it's all the same thing. And he was very devout. And he got on his knees when I was sick, and he prayed, and he traded in every good deed he ever did so that I could stay here on earth. That was his prayer when this was happening actively when I was a baby. And then I survived, and he was alive for about 3 years, the first 3 years of my life. And if we were in the same room, he was holding me. I was his. I was his little miracle child. And it's so interesting because I've had, different healers tell me now later on, when I either have told them this story as kind of my origin point, or they've just smelt it on me the way that some people who are really intuitive can, and they tell me what happened to me, and I go, yeah, that's right, you're good. You're the real deal. He and I traded life and death, and life and death touched me in the same moment. And that primed me to have an awareness just physically in my body of energy that is worshiping or rooted in death or worshiping or rooted in love. And this was very, I did not understand this for my child throughout my childhood. And the way that it manifested was as a deep energetic sensitivity to people, especially around specific adults that were not safe or that were not in integrity. I could feel it and I could feel it throughout my whole body. And it would, I didn't know how to regulate because I would feel these really strong emotional responses, to people. And it was really hard. It was really hard because it was all just seen as like a behavior issue. And looking back, you know, my mom, my parents have apologized to me for that because they're like, we didn't know there was something else going on here. And they, you know, how could they really? Because this is not anything we were taught. And a lot of my life has been comprised of recognizing and embodying truths that have been strategically buried by our culture. Because if we are to acknowledge these truths as true, it forces us to make different choices in our reality than the ones that we are making. It's really confronting, and it forces kind of an ultimatum for our systems, right? And how we interact with them, and it forces us to question them, and that is really, it's hard. I think when we talk about deconstruction and we talk about changing the system and we talk about, you know, wanting people, individual people to change because the system is made up of people. It's made up of all of us. It's hard work. It's really, really hard to have your reality, your sense of reality shattered. And I think a lot of people are experiencing that right now, in seeing these systems and seeing events play out in the way that they are so kind of emphatically. But when I was younger, I was seeing this and feeling this all the time. And I would speak things that were a little prophetic, and I could always see down the line. So, like, I started talking about what's happening right now when I was still a teenager. I'm 32, to be clear about how old I am now. So, for about half of my life, I've been saying that this is coming, this is coming, this is coming. And everyone thought I was, so many people thought I was crazy or thought I was dramatic or thought I, and that was kind of the theme when I was growing up. I would say, like, this is happening and no one is listening to me and I'm feeling it so potently in my body. And this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. That was a big theme. And then I was punished for that, or no one would listen, or people would dismiss me. And then my nervous system would just freak out. And so I was really severely depressed when I was a child, and I had so much anxiety, and I was being actively gaslit. So it was really, really it was hard. It was really hard to be, you know, a lot of the people I work with will be like, yeah, I had this moment once I became an adult where something happened and I realized, oh my gosh, the environment I grew up in was lying to me. I knew it was lying to me the whole entire time I was there. Literally, as long as I can remember. And that is like, I don't know which is more maddening. I don't know which is more traumatizing. And it's not a contest, right? There's no score to keep here. But like, sometimes I wish I had had more ignorance in my childhood because I don't feel like I actually got to fully ever be a child because I was so aware of how unjust the place we are in is and has been this whole time. Without ever getting the ignorance is bliss, I'm a child. And so it's okay for me to be ignorant to certain things because I'm a literal child. And I think all children deserve to have that innocence. But I didn't really ever get that in any real way. And, you know, I did have a certain sense of pressure. And I think my siblings probably felt this too, although I don't want to speak for them at all. But with, you know, this the my family has this legacy of public service and of sacrifice and of integrity to a fault sometimes, where, you know, it's like, okay, if my dad was the president of the Little League and was start running the Boy Scout troops. He started the Cub Scout troop, and he was president of the Social Services Board, and he was the executive director of a nonprofit that did employment and training for people who were out of work. And he was volunteering on political campaigns to try to get people in office, and he was successful at running these campaigns and flipping our congressional district blue for the first time in like 40 years or something, you know, so that he could then influence a policy, hopefully, that would be more equitable for everyone. But also, he had taken a low key vow of poverty at work. Like, that means if I'm not being a little adult all day on a Saturday, I'm not going to see my father because he's being everybody else's father. Or being everyone else's savior, right? It's like this savior complex that I've had to deconstruct, and that he is deconstructed to a degree, and he is also acknowledged. And you know, all of this with my parents, I'm really grateful we have talked about all of it, and it's been ugly and messy and hard, but we're, you know, getting to this place and have gotten to this place that feels really honest. And that's all I'm ever asking for is like, can we just acknowledge what the truth is? Because that's always been my curse, is seeing certain points of truth that no one else is acknowledging until it's too late. And so it's that kind of Cassandra complex where it's like, I've been talking about this forever and you called me crazy, or you literally punished me for it or cast me out or whatever. So that was so much of my childhood. And there's something else here I want to touch on, because I was talking about my grandfather, my grandpa Bill, earlier, and he, you know, is the one that we traded life and death, and we actually traded it again when he was actively dying. So he was a chemist, and he invented Seven and DEET and pesticides. He invented them at Union Carbide in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And you know, those are such a source of harm when we look at ecocide and the climate crisis and what's happening in our health also, because they're really bad for our bodies and can make us sick. And he didn't know the implications of he didn't know all of those implications. If he did, I'm sure he would have done things differently. But when my father did ask him, you know, my dad was in college, you know, the same conversations where he was like, how can you be a man of science and a man of such a devoutly religious person? He also said, like, you know, that stuff's like, those chemicals are not good for you to be around. It was more of a concern. They didn't understand the implications overall. I think there was this thought that, like, once we process what we're doing, it will then be safe. I don't know. I have no idea. I never got to have that conversation with him. But my dad said, like, this is probably going to kill you, like working around all of these chemicals your whole career and experimenting with them to try and find the right mix of them. And he looked at my dad and said, if I shave a few years off the end of my life, but a single mother in an urban area who's working two jobs can afford to put green food on her table for her children, that's a fair trade to me. And when my dad told me that when I was a young adult or a younger adult than I am now, it clicked into place for me that my grandfather was, I think, two generations out from the Great Hunger in Ireland, which was not a famine, which is what we're taught it was. It was constructed, right, by the British Empire, Queen Victoria. They strategically shipped all of the food in Ireland, the meat and the other vegetables besides potatoes and fish, and grains. They shipped all of it out of Ireland under armed guard. And the only food that was legal for Irish people to grow and eat were potatoes. And then there was a blight on the crop. And then they starved to death or had to leave. The population of Ireland was cut in half during the Great Hunger through the diaspora, through people leaving, and then through people dying. So my grandfather was still very much in that and trying to repair that. He was trying to feed the world. That was his mission, because he saw the population boom of the you know, when all the boomers were born, and he saw the way that agriculture was not able to keep up with the population boom. And so from his perspective, he was really trying to prevent what happened to our family from ever happening again. Because, you know, for most Irish American families, we don't talk about it. I'm the first generation, 150 years later, plus, to talk about what actually happened to our family and why we're here. And at the same time that, the Great Hunger was happening and there was so much death and there was so much loss, they made so many of our communal or the Irish communal grieving processes illegal or highly, highly regulated and highly punished. So at the same time that we, were attempting to grieve what was happening, our grief mechanisms communally and on an individual level were stripped of us. So that when you hold grief in the body, when you're not able to process it, it leads to things like alcoholism. It leads to things like eating disorders. It leads to things like OCD. It leads to various chronic mental health, specifically disorders that then become passed down generationally. I have had an eating disorder since I was 9 years old. And my grandfather, when he was dying, I was 2 and a half. And we went down to where he was dying. I think they were living in North Carolina. They had retired to Grandfather Mountain in North Carolina. And we went down there. I think there was an awareness for my parents that this was like the last time we were probably going to see my grandfather before he died. And till the day she died, years later, my grandmother would tell me that I specifically kept him alive for 2 weeks longer. Because of the 2 weeks that we were there, he had already stopped eating because he had a really aggressive internal organ cancer that he and I think like it was literally like all of the people that had been on his lab team at Union Carbide also died of cancer within like the same 6 month or year window of time or something in the 90s, which is really wild because it's really you can see the cause and effect in real time. But he had already stopped eating. He wouldn't eat no matter what. And if I brought him food, he would eat it with me. So I would bring him food every day while we were there and we would eat it. And so it was this moment where we had already traded life and death. He traded in all of the good deeds of his life so that I might stay here. And that was something he did. And he chose to activate in his own spiritual belief system, right? Regardless of if you believe that or not, listening to this, it's what he was doing. And then, without understanding what I was doing, I did a similar thing with him a few years later. And then I have been deconstructing disordered eating since I was not literally since I was 9 years old. And so much of, our power ancestrally, like my family line, our power has been wrapped up in food, in either not having food or having food after not having food and not knowing how to navigate that. And also, like, I was chubby when I was little, and it's literally, I think, in a biological sense, my DNA was like, hold on to it. You come from people who have starved, so we need to hold on to as much nourishment and nutrients as we can, because what if we starve again? And so it's just interesting to look at these themes. The way that they swirl around and the way that they're kind of ever present from all of these different angles and different lenses, and that in my family line, we've all played a part in carrying the pain and also deconstructing parts of the pain and trying to ultimately deconstruct that experience that it doesn't happen to us and doesn't happen to other people, right? Like that's a big part of my family's legacy is that if you get one rung further up the ladder, you reach behind you and you pull the other people up with you. That's the entire reason you get elevated is so that you can make the top more equitable. You can bring the top down to everybody. You can bring those resources. You can make the mountaintop something that isn't impossible to reach for the people who don't have the privilege of climbing. And so when I think about, my journey to this point, so much of it has been painful and confusing and mysterious, right? Like I think that the church, something the church has done is it gives us guarantees, right? Especially Catholic Church. Catholic, when you're raised Catholic, you get a checklist. You do X, Y, and Z, babe, you're gonna go to heaven. You do A, B, and C, you're going to hell. Like you have these rules that are so cut and dry, and there's a sense of certainty. And I think that that's why a lot of people gravitate to religion specifically, not necessarily spirituality, but religion, these different religious ideologies or theological identification is that it will give you a guarantee of what will happen when you die, which we do not have. And so a big part of my job now, and that my journey has primed me for, is that it's all a mystery. It's above my pay grade. I just told you all of these things that have ha really truly happened in my life, happened in my family line, that are all connected in these ways that feel very potent and feel almost divinely designed because of how specific and connected they are. And I'm sure there are people that will hear this if they are still listening at this point and will poo-poo what I'm saying or might say that I'm whatever. But at the end of the day, it's a mystery. It's above my pay grade to understand all of it. I quite literally don't have the brain capacity in my little human mind to fully understand the divine design as we are living within it, or the full design of reality as we are moving within it. And so a big part of my job and a big part of my journey has been understanding how to interact with the mysteries. The divine mysteries that move through this life. It's a language that you can learn, and that doesn't mean you understand the mysteries. It means you know how to interact with them and how to tend to them with a certain kind of integrity and reverence. And all of that was very, the first part of that was my childhood, my adolescence. And it's like now I'm in this place where I feel really empowered to interact with the mysteries. But when I was younger, it literally was just being in darkness and being in what felt like the upside down by myself. And now it's like we're in the upside down, but we're here together, right? Like there's so many more people. And there's so many people I've met and have interacted with the past couple of years, especially, who were also in the upside down when they were kids, but we were isolated from each other. And now we've just been able to find each other more so that we can start getting to work together in the ways that we are meant to, toward collective liberation and toward this kind of these system overhauls that these systems have taken hundreds and hundreds, sometimes thousands of years to build. So we're a drop in the bucket, right? Like this isn't about changing everything right now. We of course should try to expedite the reduction of harm and changing things so that we can all live in a fair and just and equitable society as soon as possible, obviously. And at the same time, there's a humility that comes along with doing this work where it's like we're gonna fail at certain points and we just have to keep going because it's bigger than us. And by bigger than us, I don't just mean bigger than the individuals who have the privilege of doing justice work, because it is a privilege to be able to have the space, especially with the demographic that I am. Like I'm so privileged in so many ways within the hierarchies we're forced to operate within. Like it's a privilege to be able to do the different kinds of work that I do. And at the same time, it's not just about me, obviously, and it's not even just about the people that are living here now. It's for the future. I am a product, and so much of my journey has been about my ancestry and recognizing everything my ancestors tried to build, everything my ancestors tried and failed at in terms of creating a different reality than the reality they gave to us now to operate within. And so part of that is recognizing that this is for the future too. This is a long con and it spans generations in terms of rewiring these systems. So it can be just as important to really examine, and I think it's also essential to the collective liberation process to examine your personal liberation. Like we need both in order for both to really take root and have any effect. But yeah, it was really a journey through the darkness and through being really separated, feeling really separate from myself and feeling like I was just wrong. Everything I did and said was just wrong. And some of that was imposed upon me by individual people telling me straight up that I was wrong. But a lot of it was also just, as you were kind of touching on earlier, our culture just telling me that I'm wrong for existing the way that feels natural for me to exist as a little spooky woman in the world. So that was kind of the childhood deep dive. I'm of course open to any questions.
Well, it's spooky season and I am beyond excited for it. This is my favorite time of year because, pumpkin spice, literally everything. But it goes deeper than that. And you mentioned something that I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this because you are an incredible human being. You already know that. And I love sitting here like listening to you speak. And I could probably do it
No.
for literally hours, but we don't have that long. But you mentioned about collective liberation. And why that is significant to me is I sat down and talked to our friend Julia, and she's an incredible human being that I had the honor of sitting down and talking to. And I don't know if you follow Julia on social media, but she talks a lot about collective liberation and individual liberation. And this is now the second episode that we'll be talking about this. And I want to keep talking about it because it looks different for each person. So I would love for you to do a dive into what collective liberation looks like to you, but also the individual aspect, because we hear a lot about individualism and how it connects into consumerism, but this is a little bit different. This is the individual liberation, like liberating yourself to help liberate your community. That's decolonization within itself and going back to the true roots of community care and self-care without the colonization aspect. So what does collective liberation look to you, and how can others kind of put that together for themselves too? Because each person sees it differently. But what does it look like to you?
I'm not, there are so many people who are way more qualified to speak on collective liberation than me, but this is what it means to me in this context. It speaks to interdependence as opposed to aggressive individualism or codependence, because within the systems we operate within now, that's kind of where we fall. That's where we land. I work a lot with relationships, how we relate to one another. That's a and navigating those. Because that's what, when you start to have different awakenings to the system or to your idea of divinity or to different parts of yourself, that's what people I find in my work with clients, that's what a lot of people need help with, is how do I navigate this relationship or these relationships that are expecting me to be the old version of myself that no longer is who I am? How do I integrate this in a way? How do I navigate this? And so we're taught, this codependence where I owe you all of myself and you owe me all of you, no questions asked, no limits, no boundaries. Or or the opposite end of the spectrum, that individualism, that aggressive individualism, where it's I don't owe anybody anything and they don't owe me anything, and so I'll claw my way to the top. And both of these are a product of capitalism, right? Where we and the intersection of capitalism and the Christian industrial complex, where it's like you're either the person in power who doesn't owe anybody anything and who believes nobody owes you anything, so you're going to hoard your wealth out of that scarcity. Or you're being exploited, which means pour yourself out for me in full, and I won't give you anything for that. Or if I do, it definitely won't be equitable because you exist for me to mine and exploit and pillage. It really is also mirrored, in how we treat the earth, in how we treat the earth and her resources. So, for me, collective liberation and this idea of individual liberation, how those things intersect, lies in this idea of interdependence, where I recognize that in order for us to be in community together, I need to have what I need, and you need to have what you need. And I need to meet my emotional needs in a specific way. And I need to also understand what my needs are and be able to communicate about them in a healthy and effective way if it's something I can't meet by myself. And I at the same time, the whole point of me having my needs met is so that I can show up with you and we can then meet each other's needs. Because the idea that we can meet every need by ourselves is total bullshit. Like, we are social creatures on a biological level. We need co-regulation on a biological level. We need to be in a certain kind of community. We need to have a certain kind of safety in order to thrive. And so when I think about this discussion, I'm really called into the very kind of like nuanced ways that this plays out as you're kind of working through the decolonization process on the inner level, right? Like realizing the ways that colonization has impacted you and has gotten inside of your brain and inside of your emotional space and how you interact and how you relate to other people. And like, if I don't know what my needs are on a real way, if I'm not in communication with myself in a real way, in an honest way, and if I don't haven't created that safety in my body for myself. And it's a privilege to have the space to create that safety. And at the same time, for me and for a lot of people, it can be as much as just going outside in bare feet and like laying on the earth on a patch of grass and breathing and just feeling your body breathe, just finding these moments of safety, even if they're microscopic, that then give you an opportunity to really safely check in with and connect with yourself in an honest way. When you're able to start honoring that, which none of us were taught how to do, because all of these systems bank on us not listening to ourselves, because when we listen to ourselves, everything screams and says, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is a death cult, this is a death cult, this is a death cult. I don't want to go to work today. I feel like I'm not supposed to go, I feel like I'm not supposed to go to work for 15 hours today for minimum wage. You know what I mean? Like, and if I start having that thought and that feeling consistently enough, then I maybe might say something to somebody else. And then if they hear me say it, they might say, you know what? I've been feeling that and thinking that too. And then we'll talk about it and then we'll organize and then we'll overcome, right? So these systems bank on us not having these honest conversations with ourselves first and foremost, because that's what informs how we show up collectively. How we treat ourselves is how we will treat and be treated when it comes to collective community spaces so often. And there's so much nuance here. So I try to be intentional about acknowledging that nuance, and acknowledging that like there's a lot to talk about here. So as I talk about it, I might not hit on everything because again, I'm not the most qualified person to talk about it from kind of an anthropological or sociological perspective or a lived experience perspective, because I'm a white woman with an education from a prestigious university who has had a certain kind of safety and stability offered and provided to me my entire life. And I recognize that that just like that creates these blind spots, right? And so, but when I think about the nuance of this, I think about like if you. I think about relationships, and I even think about relationships I've been in romantically, platonically, professionally, where I didn't have self-worth when I was younger. I had very, very, very low self-worth. And so I showed up in relationships trying to prove my worth. And I was codependent in at work with family members, with boyfriends, with friendships. Like I had those patterns. And when I think about that, it's like I wish, I think when we talk about being codependent and showing up in a way where like so often it's like a codependent person and a narcissist, or a codependent person and a person that's exploiting that codependence, right? Like that often can be the dynamic I think a lot of people in mainstream pop psychology or the pop healing space online, that's what they start to talk about. But like I was showing up in a manipulative way. Like I was showing up in a way where I had an agenda for every relationship. It was subconscious, it wasn't on purpose, but like my agenda was to somehow get some value and feel some value in myself by how I performed in this relationship and how that performance was re rewarded in some way, shape, or form. And so, of course, me showing up in that way was not productive, and it led to disconnection. And I wasn't the only person leading to disconnection in any of these spaces, right? It was really a game recognized game situation in terms of like the toxicities at play. And there were some time there was I'm not going to victim blame myself either. There were certain people when I was younger who were older than me, especially in professional environments or romantic environments, that really took advantage of me and knew what they were doing in a way that I didn't understand what was happening. And I don't want to discount that, but I do just want to highlight this as one example where it's like, if you're still operating in a really unhealed, from a really unhealed part of yourself, and you haven't done that work to liberate yourself from something like codependence that's really inward, it's you. And it's, yes, informed by your trauma or informed by systems outside of you. But when I pull that thread, my codependence when I was younger was informed by my dad, like my relationship with my dad. And when we pull that thread, it's not because my dad's a bad person. It's not because my dad's evil. It's not because my dad was trying to hurt me. It's because he was the last generation that was taught to ignore this trauma that had been festering in our family for over a century. And he was holding all of that in his body. And all of those generational patterns that were passed down were informed by the diaspora and the Great Hunger and colonization. So when and then also on top of that, being in America and the pressures of capitalism and late stage capitalism, like all of these things converge to create these versions of ourselves that are not able to show up in a way that is authentic. And so for me, being liberated on my inner plane and having the privilege of being put on that journey, because it really didn't feel like it was something I chose. It felt like I was something, it was something that I got to agree to. But it wasn't something, it was very much always divinely constructed when I had the opportunity to deepen into deconstructing myself. Really, on that inner plane, that is what totally has informed me being able to show up in community. And that's been there the whole time, right? Like I've been showing up in community. I've been showing up in my grandparents on my mom's side of the family have been a part of this the fight for civil rights since the 60s. And my grandfather, they still are really active in fighting for the liberation of all people, the liberation of queer people, the liberation of Black people, the liberation of immigrants. And that's a whole other deep dive where they have been on, in terms of service and public service and service to humanity, like they also have that, and they have a different set of, things that have been passed down in a more traumatic way. But for me, it was always, I was really handed the bulk of my dad's. From my dad's line to deconstruct, and in having the opportunity to do that and liberate myself, I am able to show up in the fight for collective liberation in a way that is more effective, in a way that is more impactful, in a way that decenters me more, when it's not time for me to be front and center, which is most of the time in collective liberation space. It's also humbling to recognize, like, yeah, it's not my job to save everybody. Like the white savior complex is also a Christian savior complex. When we're given figures like Jesus Christ who died on the cross for our sins, that means that there's less burden on each of us, or less responsibility rather, on each of us to show up, because he already did it, right? He did it for us, so we don't each need to show up. When in reality, and I think that's totally informed like the white savior complex of it all in social justice spaces, but that, when you kind of allow that idea to deflate, which I think naturally happens when you start to save yourself through your own personal process of liberation, from the ideas of you that aren't honest, that are rooted in trauma or rooted in different societal conditioning, or rooted in, just exposure to the death cult. When you start to uncover that true self, you're able to really tap in a new way. You're able to show up as you save yourself. You're able to show up in a way where you actually are offering what what you are designed to offer. Because we all have different gifts. We all have a different role to play. And the journey for, or the fight for collective liberation, it takes a million different shapes. It's not just, big sweeping historic moments of revolution. Yes, that's a part of it, but it's also in quiet moments where you are, woven throughout your entire day. How can I help? And that can be quiet and small sometimes too, in addition to the bigger roles that sometimes we're asked to play, or that we're asked to support other people in playing. That's something that's a big part of my journey now as well, is I support a lot of leaders. I support a lot of people who are doing really big things in the world, and I'm a sounding board for them, or I'm just a safe place for them to unpack what they're experiencing. Because when you are called into positions of leadership during times like these, there's no playbook. And so I kind of help people build those playbooks. But yeah, it's really been interesting the past few years because I did a lot of work right after I graduated college. I was living in New York and I was going to these meetings at the People's Power Assembly, and I was doing People's Monday, and I was doing going to Black Lives Matters protests. I was demonstrating for about 2 years. I demonstrated like 3 to 5 times a week, and was also going to different community-based seminars where I was learning about our real history. I learned a lot of Black history. In a way, I always knew I wasn't being told the truth, but I didn't then have access to people who were going to tell me that truth in the most honest way possible, or the most informed way or educated way possible. And so I was really privileged to be able to sit in and learn from a number of different people and be a part of different demonstrations that were really, really powerful and really impactful. And it's been interesting to see the evolution of what was just reserved for social justice spaces, even just 10 years ago. I'm now seeing people that were definitely not in those spaces with us, talk about these things and assume these positions and use their voice, even just on social media, to say, hey, this is wrong. Or, hey, there's a different way we can do this. Or, hey, I actually really care about this. And I know that living in the age of information, like, it can feel so small to just be like, oh, I guess I'll just post about this. But that's how we keep truth alive, and it's how we keep each other motivated to keep living in that truth. It's really a lot more important, I think, than it feels sometimes. And a lot more impactful than it feels sometimes. And if that's all you have in terms of you don't know what else to do, do it. And using your voice in that space will lead you to people and other voices who can then maybe help you direct your energy in ways that feel more physical or feel more impactful to you. But it's been really interesting to see the ways that more voices are joining in to really fight for and secure collective liberation. And I think that, who am I? I'm just a gal on the internet, but I really feel like we're reaching a threshold. In the past, week or so specifically, it's October 4th, 2025, as we're talking today here, and seeing the number of people who were talking about this flotilla. That was trying to bring aid and food and the humanitarian mission into Gaza. It's seeing the number of people who are paying attention to that with their voice and sharing about it relative to the last one that was, what, 6 weeks ago? Like, there are so many more people, and it does feel like a tide is turning in terms of collectively what is being accepted and acknowledged as the truth. And, we live in this time where this authoritarian regime came to power because of the largest and biggest propaganda machine in the history of the world. So, telling the truth and seeing people accept the truth, the actual truth, the truth of what's really happening, as opposed to the story that we're being told about what's being happening, that is essential. That is essential to collective liberation. That is essential to really changing things in a physical way that impacts not only us here today and people who are quite literally in chains right now or are suffering and dying in ways that are totally egregious and unnecessary and awful and abhorrent. Not just for them and not just for us, but for the future and for the future that we're building together. And I really, as defeating and awful as this it is to just wake up and look around right now, the fact that we are here together and I'm here with someone like you, Zachary, and then that I also look around at how many more people are joining the conversation, even just with one post or with one comment in real life, like that wouldn't have been spoken a month ago or 6 months ago. There is something encouraging about that. And even if it's a death mission, even if we do not succeed, it is so worth, in my eyes, in my opinion, it's so beyond worth dying for. And I don't have a death wish. I love being alive. And I hope more than anything that we can come together and be successful in the greatest collective liberation the world has ever seen, as rapidly as we possibly can, for the people of Palestine, for the immigrant community in America, for LGBTQ people, for women, for anyone with a uterus, for everybody, for people who have been brainwashed by a death cult. I really, really hope we can do that. And if we don't, I am happy and privileged to spend the rest of my life and death fighting for it, and dedicating my time and my energy to it as much as I can. And I'm just, as awful as everything is, I'm just grateful to be alive and to have the safety that I have and the privilege that I have to try and make things better, even just a little bit here and there, day by day.
And you do it so fantastically.
Oh,
If that's
thanks.
actually a word, if not, it is now because it describes you. But
Oh.
I am obsessed with this talking point, and I feel that this is going to be one of many conversations with you because we can sit here and we can talk about this literally for days on end, right?
Yes,
And
literally, I could talk about this for, till the cows come home, and I don't even have cows. They're never gonna come home. Spoiler. So I could talk about it forever.
I don't have cows either. I just have dogs, and they kind of act like it sometimes. But is there anything is there anything else that you would like to share with the audience today?
Yes, there are two things.
I
The
know that's a
first,
very loaded question, but.
no, it's I well, and this is honestly the least intense thing I will have said this entire conversation. Please, right now, if you're listening to this, if you've gotten to this point in this conversation, first, thank you so much for being here and supporting Zachary's work and the work that they're doing at the Rise Above, and also for listening to me ramble on about all of these things. Thank you for being here and being a part of the conversation. And also, please do something today. I don't care if you have to clear part of your schedule. Nothing is as important as what I'm about to say. Please do something today with no agenda other than cultivating joy for yourself, even if it's just a little bit. We need joy right now more than ever. And I think that we start to feel really solemn and we start to feel really in deference to all of the pain and suffering that's going on in the world. We feel like it is crass to experience joy or to create joy or cultivate joy for ourselves. But please do something if you have even 5 minutes that is just to make yourself giggle or just to experience a little bit of brightness, because that goes a long way. It is sustenance. And, when we talk about nutrition, part of that is what you feed your body in terms of food and fuel. But part of it is also what you're feeding your heart and what you're feeding your mind. And we need to be fueled. We need fuel for this journey and for this fight together. So please, please make sure you're nourishing yourself with joy, because it's so important. And the second thing is, if you also, again, sometime this week, create something just with the agenda of creating. It doesn't have to be joyful. You can create a really emo painting with like charcoal and dark colors if you need to. I fully endorse as a former Tumblr kid. But please do something that's creative to just get a little bit of energy out of your body, because that really it can disarm your emotional space. And right now we're being overwhelmed with emotional bait, essentially. We are overwhelmed with all of these things that are happening, and it's designed, fascism is designed to overwhelm our emotions to a point where we then become numb to them. So then we will be more complicit. So please do something to create, because when we create, we're clearing our emotional channels, even just a little bit, even just a little bit. And it doesn't have to be good, and you don't even have to finish it. Get some Play-Doh and mush it up in your hands. Or if you're making your coffee, the way that you pour in your cream and your sugar in a really creative way. If you're making an oatmeal bowl, put some fruit on top of it and make a smiley face. Get a post-it note and doodle a weird, I don't know, shape. Like literally, it could be anything. But just create something today, with no agenda, and then do something for yourself with no agenda other than cultivating joy, because those are two things we need, and they seem like they are extra bonus. Oh, I don't need to do this right now. There are more important things. But the only way we can actually sustain ourselves through the more important things is if we take care of ourselves in these really subtle ways, and we feed ourselves and fuel ourselves in these subtler ways. So that's what I would like to say. And I would also like to say that I'm really proud of you, whoever is listening to this right now. And you might be like, Meg, you don't even know me. But guess what? You are alive right now. And looking around at right now, and looking around at all of human history, and looking around and talking to my elders about, how the past 100 years or so has been in terms of showing up in the world and living, like, depending on who you are. This is a really, really complex time to be a human being. More has changed in the past couple of decades than has ever changed before, at one time. It's a really, really, really rapid transition that's been really jarring and has been hard and difficult. And I'm really, really proud of you for being here. I'm proud of you for being a part of conversations like these and opening yourself up to different perspectives. And I'm also proud of you for just being here. It's hard. It's really hard. And so, even if you didn't do anything today at all, or even if you did something bad today, I'm proud of you for being here. Okay. And I believe in you. I believe in your ability to be here and be your full self in a way that not only helps you feel really fulfilled and joyful and calm and at peace with who you are, but also in a way that extends that out to other people. So thank you for being here, and I'm proud of you. And that's what I would like to say.
Meg, thank you so much for coming on the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. And you have an open invite anytime, and you have anything else you would like to share. You also have an invite to collaborate with us on social media, which we are at the Rise Above Justice Movement, and we're on all streaming platforms and YouTube. And we have a lot more conversations coming. We have a lot more just these deep diving conversations, essentially. So, Meg, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I greatly appreciate you.
Thank you so much. This was such a lovely conversation, and thank you so much for all of the work that you are doing. And I want to ask on behalf of the people, how can we support you? How can we support the movement? How can we support your work specifically beyond just, following, liking, sharing on social media and liking, commenting, leaving reviews for the pod? How can we support you further?
So one thing to note is we are not a nonprofit organization,
Yep.
but we have a Patreon that we're getting ready to launch that people can become members and get behind the scenes, like camera footage of the work that we're doing and what it takes to put together the podcast. So we have a Patreon. We also have a online merch store, which me and my co-founder Gwen Levy of Gwen Levy and the Breakdown, who is an independent music artist. We have a merch line that we are getting ready to fully launch. It's available now. We also have a website, which is riseabovejusticemovement.com, where people can go on and they can read about who we are, what we do, and again, like share our content on social media, leave reviews on the podcast episodes, subscribe to our YouTube as we have some big projects coming. But those are the main ways that I can think of, and just, spread the word about the work that we're doing, because ultimately the quickest way that things spread is word of mouth. And we obviously collaborate with a lot of other movements and content creators and activists and advocates in these systems. And we have some more hard-hitting conversations. We just interviewed Jess Michaels, who's a 1991 Jeffrey Epstein survivor. We interviewed some other survivors and other religious trauma survivors as well, and we have a lot more coming. But yeah, those are the main ways that I can think of. You know, the Patreon, our merch line, which they can just go to the riseabovejusticemovement.com and they can read about everything. Everything is on there. And one of the other things that we'll be doing is highlighting other small like businesses on our website and adding things that we support. And we'll also be adding some like petitions on our website that people can sign. Because currently with the American Psychological Association, CPTSD, so cumulative or why am I blanking on the word? Cumulative PTSD, complex PTSD, that's what I was trying to think of. Complex CPT or complex PTSD, or also known as CPTSD, is not currently recognized in the DSM-5 or the upcoming DSM-6 as a diagnosable diagnosis. So there's still PTSD, but CPTSD is not currently recognized. And there's a lot of movement around getting that, you know, to be recognized by the American Psychological Association. But those are the ways that I can think of. And obviously, you know, we're open to feedback on everything and how we continue advocating, how we can continue growing who we are and the work that we're doing. And the best way to do that is to contribute to our merch line and our Patreon and become members. And other than that, that's pretty much it. And we couldn't do it without it. So.
Incredible. Thank you so much for having me. This has been so such a nourishing conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a great day, okay?
You too.
Thank you.